Okay, we're going to kick off the next session. So I hope you all had your lunch, you're all good. I know there's delays with the coffee again and that, so apologies for that. This is the usual joke with Christoph. Usually he makes it about himself, that's why I don't feel bad about it. Who am I? So sorry, Christoph. This podium is very tall. So Christoph Roth, joint CEO of Insight and Actuaries, you know him well. It's also on the Council of ASSA, so over to you, Christoph.
Yeah, thank you, Alex, for stealing literally the only joke in my repertoire. I do realize, of course, that I'm literally the only obstacle standing between yourselves and a very exciting IFRS 17 talk. So if you wish me away, I'll take it. But just for some background, I was going to do a talk very similar to this one at the General Convention last year before I gallantly and magnanimously yielded, or what did Lusani say, deferred my session to Clayton over there. So that there can be a response to I don't know, certain other people who said certain other things. So as a result of that, I'm now humbly, you know, taking this lesser forum to share my views with you. But it's a topic that I'm going to preface all of this by saying a lot of what I want to talk about should be par for the course for this audience, but maybe what I want to do is just test with you some of my thinking and invite some comments, because I think a lot of harm is being done in this domain, and I'll explain my thinking in a second, and I dream about coming up with a framework which perhaps regulators could use and which perhaps auditors could use when they think about compliance with a self-sustaining option requirement. And, you know, maybe part of today is a bit of preaching to the converted, but with the aim of soliciting some comments about a framework that I want to propose. Daniel Shapiro has done a lot to assist me here, and Lisa Roman, is she here today? I don't think she's here. Also helped me a lot. The only reason I asked them is because I plan to write a paper about this, and you know, then I will propose the RART model, which sounds really stupid. So, but I thought if we call it the Shapiro Roman RART model, that sounds awesome. So I need some co-authors so that we can at least sound vaguely intellectually interesting. Right, so the first question to ask is, why bother? Just like a decaf coffee, why bother? You know, we are kind of in this regulatory orphan space. We've got NHI to worry about. It's certainly been very unpopular since 2007 at Polokwane to do anything about developing our regulatory environment. But it is now 20 years later, you know, and a lot of things should have happened and haven't happened. And we can rest on our laurels and wait for the world to change. But I think, you know, other than that, my inner health actuary child still wants to play health actuary from time to time. There are still improvements that we can and should make, and I think we should keep on fighting the good fight, even if it's about fixing the regulatory environment in which we find ourselves today. I see some heads nodding. Hope you agree, and that's not to discount from all other kinds of health reforms that are necessary and that must happen in which one or the other way, but I'm suggesting we can still bother about the world we find ourselves in today. Right, so at BHF, was it 2 weeks ago? I think it's 2 weeks. I presented on an adjacent topic, but I kind of showed a slide like this, which is, again, I think very familiar territory for this audience, which is to say we have, you know, all of the reforms that were aimed towards access and equity were very quickly implemented after the Act of 1998 was promulgated in 2000. Immediately got a community rating up and around with PMBs, expanded PMBs, but on the right-hand side of this line, again, it just boggles my mind how few people remember this. I think in this room, I would hope at least that most people understand this really well, but outside of that, whether you talk to trustees, the regulator, media, other stakeholders, people just forget. And maybe as a side note, it's up to us to remind all of our colleagues out there, the world was never supposed to work without risk equalization or mandatory cover, all of the other elements that are listed on the right-hand side there. They were not implemented, sometimes for good reasons and sometimes for bad reasons. I'll talk about that. And I talked a little bit about what the private sector can do about this at BHF, but what I want to focus on today is this one and two particular kinds of risk equalization. So some of this, you know, is just maybe terminology I want to introduce and that I think we should be talking about more and that I hope to articulate quite clearly. But we have, let's call it inter-scheme risk equalization, which is like the traditional REF we were all dreaming about in 2005 and 6. What I want to suggest is there's also intra-scheme risk equalization, which would be equalizing risk between options. And so that's what I want to focus on today. If we do this, we need to start with some kind of a literature review. So we'll go back to David Wilkie, Mutuality and Solidarity in 97. It's a paper that was written in 97 about life insurance. I think it was 2005 that Heather McLeod kind of adopted it to the healthcare environment in South Africa. And our current legislation was crafted very much on the principle of social solidarity. So community rating enshrines this principle of social solidarity to some degree, and that's enshrined in Section 29(1)(n) of the Act, which all of you should know by heart, is the one that says that premiums can only be varied based on family size or income. We can call it the community rating section of the Act. Now, social solidarity, to simplify it really in our world, we should think about social solidarity as two things. There should be risk cross-subsidies, which means from healthy to unhealthy. There should be income cross-subsidies, which obviously means from high income to low income. And these are the legislature wanted to enable these through 29(1)(n), saying family size and income. And the income part was intended to say, you know, you can use income bands to make sure that you have an income cross-subsidy. But where I'm going with this is that the legislature never thought about income cross-subsidies between options, because an income band can't achieve that, right? So the spanner in the works is this section 33(2)(b), which you also know by heart. I know you do. As far as I can tell, and maybe if anyone disagrees, you can raise your hand, but there's this clause in the Act 33(2)(b). It actually talks about registration of new options, but it does say that options must be self-supporting in terms of membership and financial performance. Now, that's what I want to focus on today, is these words and also the implication. It doesn't say in so many words that options must be surplus-making, but the current administration at the council certainly interprets it like that. As far as I can tell, and I'd love to hear, it might be easier to survey this audience than to survey all of the medical schemes out there, but every single loss-making option out there that I know of in every medical scheme, restricted and open, have been receiving letters from the council sort of after benefit approval saying, we've noted that you're not compliant with 33(2)(b) and we're monitoring your option. Actuarial joke maybe, but even single option restricted schemes have been receiving this letter. Thanks for laughing, Matthew. So I have a second joke. I'm like short, but I also have that one. So, you know, think about it. If you have like a 300% restricted scheme, single option scheme, there are many of those out there. They must make losses. If you make a surplus, then your investment income will just make your reserves skyrocket forever. There's a point where the board must say, the reserves should stabilize. Even those have been receiving letters from the council saying that your single option appears to be loss-making. And of course, then for the auditors, where Carolyn is up after, but the non-compliance notes that we have in every single financial statement out there, literally every multi-option scheme in the country has a non-compliance note. And so my great ambition, which admittedly is naively ambitious, is to try and come up with a framework that could better define what we should do here. I have been in meetings, the Council of Medical Schemes a long, long time ago. I think One that I still recall was when Paul Bosch was still involved at the FSU, where the council openly said in those days that self-supporting need not necessarily mean making a surplus. I think it's something an actuary can understand, and I'll try to explain that in more detail. But at the moment, that's not the thinking. And of course, 33.2 has other provisions as well. It also talks about financially sound, and the D is particularly interesting, very relevant, that an option should not jeopardize the financial soundness of any existing benefit option within a medical scheme. So there is provision for some kind of interaction between options. Now, why bother? Again, I think significant harm is currently being done because of the way this clause is being implemented and understood. And I think it's up to us to speak up. I don't think any other profession has the capability or the wherewithal to speak up about this. So I would say on the one hand side, there's like Section 29.1N, Regulation 4 also says that people can move freely between options, and then we have the self-sustaining option requirement on the right-hand side. Bos of Steenkamp, when he was still in charge of strategy at the CMS, he once said that this provision, 33.2, self-supporting options, it's such an innocent, seemingly innocent provision. You know, if you have many products, they should be self-sustaining. It sounds okay. And I think what he said and what he fully admitted is the legislature never foresaw that people will end up selecting options based on risk. Right? To us, it sounds patently obvious. I mean, how else? But if you go back 25 years before the new act came in, the legislature had this view that medical schemes will kind of put options out there and people will select options. And some sick people will go up and some sick people will go down and some healthy people will go up and some healthy people will go down. And I think it was informed with a view that maybe risk aversion will play as much of a role as your health profile, right? And I think it's understandable, but I think if you go back to the intention of the legislature, you can make a case today that there were some unintended consequences, or at least there were conditions that the legislature didn't foresee when this act was drafted. Because the data is in. And I got this just from publicly available data, so this is just using age on the x-axis, but you can clearly see that, you know, whether you look at contributions or net or claims on the left and right respectively, older people are claiming more and they are paying more because they are in more expensive options. We could make this much more stark if I used chronicity or a better clinical indication of high-risk beneficiaries, and you will clearly see, we all know this, that the sick people are buying up and the healthy people are buying down. And that's also where the loss-making options are. Again, I think this is from council statutory return data in 2022. You'll see that loss-making, so I'm plotting the net healthcare result on the y-axis, and as you go to the right, you'll see the people inhabiting older options are in loss-making options. And obviously that should be a concern. If we need that option to be self-sustaining in terms of the literal interpretation of 33.2b, then it means that you would have sick people having to cross-subsidize other sick people, to put it very simply. And I think the way to think about this is the legislature did not foresee this, did not expect that people will choose based on risk profile. Those dots on the right are very small, but I want to suggest that that shouldn't suggest that we shouldn't look at them. In those tiny little small dots are people getting dialysis, are people with cancer, are people lying on ventilators in an ICU, are people who desperately need help. And we should be able to cross-subsidize them if we believe in the principle of social solidarity, but we can't. Right, so I want to leave you with an archetypical picture of a multi-option scheme. This isn't a real scheme, this is a fake scheme, but most schemes look a little bit like this. And we said social solidarity has risk and income cross-subsidies, right? My kind of mental archetypical picture of a multi-option scheme looks a little bit like this, that you have your kind of middle options often making relatively small surpluses where your economically active population might lie on a per life per month basis. And then you have your more comprehensive options on the right, and they tend to be loss-making, not always, but mostly. And again, that should be the case if we believe in a risk cross-subsidy as per social solidarity. And then on the left-hand side, we have the low-cost options, whether you think about a hospital plan, whether you think about a kind of a capitated primary, you know, the bond caps and the key cares of the worlds, then you also want a subsidy in that direction. We can call it a risk cross-subsidy. So admittedly an oversimplification, but I want to suggest that if you believe in social solidarity, and if you accept that certain people select certain options which the legislature did not foresee, then you must have loss-making options. Right, and that's a message that I think is not clearly enough articulated out there. I want to, maybe another way to formulate this, the spirit of the Act is in conflict with the letter of the Act. There's no doubt that the spirit of the Act is all about non-discrimination, about community rating, and that you shouldn't be penalized because of your state of health. And now the Act wasn't wrongly written. The Act just didn't expect that people will select based on their state of health, which again, as I say, seems so obvious to us, but is not necessarily, you know, with hindsight, it seems obvious. But 33.2, I would say, promotes direct or indirect discrimination. And so maybe the soundbite, if you want to grab media attention or be controversial or get the attention of, is really just to say that the literal interpretation of 33.2b is promoting discrimination based on your state of health, and it's happening today. And I think every time the regulator is writing a letter to a scheme saying we're monitoring you, and I sit in countless benefit design sessions where we say, shucks, you know, let's just put an extra percentage increase at the top just to satisfy the regulator that we're trying to do something. But what are we doing? We're just penalizing sick people for being sick, right? And what I want to propose is I don't think we need to go to Parliament. I don't think we need to amend the law. I don't think we need to come with new regulations. I think the existing wording in the Act already allows us to think differently about this. And that's kind of what I want to propose. But there's more complexity. So first, you know, let's just look at the way risk segregation is playing out today. So again, coming back to my archetypical kind of scheme picture. And I plot PMBs in blue, and you can clearly see that even though PMBs are common benefits, the older people are claiming more because they're sicker. And most schemes have this kind of picture, with some, of course, exceptions out there. An informed and rational consumer, and again, all of you know this, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but an informed and rational consumer in option F should downgrade to A or B or C, or even D. It would be a rational decision. Of course, the savings you would get from the premiums that you pay would be more than the out-of-pocket expenses that you're going to pay out of your own pocket by virtue of not being covered for that anymore. And if you want to be cynical, you could say that, you know, informed and rational consumers would ultimately destroy our industry, right? I think Johnny Broomberg liked to say that he thinks the industry is held together by some degree of apathy, or some degree of inertia. You know, just the fact that people don't bother really thinking carefully about this. Because what happens, of course, when the informed and rational consumer goes down is that you compromise these options, the A and B and Cs. And they become less affordable, so they might lose some young and healthy members and the system starts crumbling. So that's the first dilemma that we face today. And some schemes choose to deliberately keep segregated risk pools, you know, by hook or by crook, find a way to keep the healthier people in option A, B, and C so that we can make it possible to maintain a more affordable premium there. The other half of this is to say, if you have these loss-making options at the top, these very comprehensive loss-making options, virtually every multi-option scheme I know of has one or two of those, what do you do? And we often sit in benefit design and, you know, you get these letters from the regulator saying it's non-compliant and you need to do something about it. And you often have trustees saying we can't have a product that's making losses. No one would sell a product if it's a loss-making product, you know. And I think what those arguments forget is regulation four, and that you're a member of a scheme, you're not a member of an option. You don't belong to an option, you belong to a scheme. So if you close down the option, you will remain on the medical scheme. And of course, if you try to increase the contributions of that option, you're just going to increase the pressure to buy down that I showed in the previous slide. If you cut the benefits of that option, you're never going to solve it. Yeah, I can demonstrate. If you took option F here and cut every benefit that you allowed to cut and took it down to PMBs only, you would still, because of 33.2, you would still have a product that offers less benefits and costs more than A, B, and C. So you can't do that either. You don't have a consistent product line. So that's the one complexity. The second one is just, you know, schemes are using some degree of risk segregation to put a diverse set of products in the market out there. Right, so I'm trying to illustrate this by four quadrants. If we think about the risk cross subsidies vertically and the income cross subsidies horizontally, so every medical scheme's dream is to have a low-cost option, isn't it? So now maybe a hospital plan or maybe like a capitated low-cost plan can attract healthy lives. And there are some of those out there, like low-cost products with a healthy profile. I think those products exist, and again, this is a cynical and unfortunate thought to ponder. There are many of those products that have failed over the years. The technical name is a low-cost option gone wrong. And that's a low-cost option that would have been low-cost if it managed to protect its profile, but a bunch of pensioners were attracted to it, and the profile went off of the rails. And we know of many of those, right? So like a hospital plan almost entirely inhabited by pensioner members. What happens to those options? Well, they close. And so the low-cost options, we can evoke like some kind of Darwinian thinking to say the reason we have some low-cost options that work today is just because the ones that didn't work had to close down. Right. So, but that's on the low-cost. And schemes desperately try to create kind of these ring-fenced. Of course, you can't create a hard ring-fence. So it's either fortuitously or by design or by default, but some medical schemes manage to kind of assemble a healthier population in a certain option. Then you can have a low-cost product that can compete. On the bottom right, so now we have high income but healthy, which is often referred to as the worried healthy. And those people that the legislature thought would go to more comprehensive options based on risk aversion. And they tend to be surplus-making. And actually, I think every medical scheme's entire existence depends on this group of people, right? Which is not a sustainable picture to ponder because information, again, an informed worried healthy would understand, as I've illustrated before, that it would make sense to buy down. And then at the top, we have the kind of perennial, very comprehensive loss-making option, which is, again, as I said, virtually every multi-option medical scheme has one of those. And of course, all the other three quadrants are loss-making. That almost all of us are cross-subsidized by the worried healthy, or some people call them the worried wealthy, but prefer the worried healthy. So what I'm trying to say is that, of course, some degree of risk segregation makes sense for medical schemes if you want to have a range of products. But there's even more complexity that, again, is maybe not always immediately obvious, and that's income elasticity of demand. So sticking to my little quadrant there, our risk cross-subsidies obviously are intended to work like this. So within a scheme like what I'm advocating for, between options, or the risk equalization fund that was contemplated way back when, was intending to do this. But health economists will make us believe that there's something called income elasticity of demand, which is unnecessarily fancy words to say, if you make more money, you consume more healthcare. You know, we've done some studies that suggest that we can see that and others that we can't. But the thinking is just like if you make more money, you buy a bigger car, buy a bigger house, and you also consume more healthcare. It doesn't necessarily mean that you are sicker or unhealthier. It might just mean that you go to the pediatrician rather than the GP. You know, there's that element of consuming more healthcare. And as long as we use claims as a proxy for health, which we often end up doing inadvertently, then rich people appear less healthy than lower income people. Does that make sense? So to the degree that that kind of correlation exists, that we have an axis like this, and again, also, these people should opt out if they're rational and those options should close because they failed. These can't go anywhere, so they stay, and of course these also stay. So that's another reason why we expect this kind of diagonal pattern. And that means if you try to do a risk cross-subsidy, you end up taking from the healthy to give to the unhealthy, but you also end up taking from the poor to give to the rich. This is one of the reasons that risk equalization failed in 2006. I don't think this was completely apprehended. In the papers that Heather McLeod wrote, there was a lot said about, you know, we need to impose explicit income cross-subsidies over risk equalization to make it work because of this dilemma. But I just want to leave this thought that in a social solidarity environment, we want risk cross subsidies, but you can very easily, because of income elasticity of demand, you can quite easily end up doing the wrong thing by taking from the poor and giving to the high income people if you do this or if you do it in the wrong way. So there's some complexity. But what I want to suggest is that this word self-supporting is still, it leaves a little bit of wiggle room for interpretation, right? What does self-supporting mean? What does it mean if you think about the entire act and the spirit of the act and the context in which the legislature must have meant this, rather than, I think, a blunt kind of application or enforcement today saying if you're surplus making, you're compliant, and if you're loss making, you're not compliant. And I'm not pointing fingers at the regulator here. I think the auditors all similarly hold a similar interpretation. And I want to propose, you know, hopefully we can come up with a better model as the actual profession. You know, the Shapiro, Ramon. Okay, thanks, Matthew. I'll put my surname in it if you want. So here's an example. And, you know, there are many ways to do this. And we can make it extremely complicated, but, you know, we need to keep some pragmatism in mind. And one way to kind of just do this, obviously, would be to distinguish between common and supplementary benefits. And one way to look at common benefits would be PMBs. Identification of PMBs is surprisingly problematic in many administrative environments. Some administrators are better than others. But if you do what I do for a living, you'll know that many of the administrators out there cannot accurately identify every claim line that is a PMB and everyone that's not. One proxy that one could use here would be the statutory returns PMB curve, which the Council for Medical Scheme publishes. There's all kinds of problems with that, but at least gives you a proxy if you have an age profile of what the PMB expenditure would be. This is a real medical scheme. It's a dual option medical scheme. It's got two options. Option A is more comprehensive, option B less so. Here I'm just plotting a gross result. Claims minus contributions. You can see even on a gross level before non-health, option A is making a deficit, so that would be non-compliant with 33.2B. So what if we then take the approach of saying, okay, if we take PMBs and separate it out, we come up with a community-rated PMB premium and then look at the PMB claims below that. Again, here, for purposes of this example, we used the statutory returns curve. If you have a better indicator of PMB claims, you could use that. Now we're seeing that what I want to suggest, I don't know, the slides might be dark, but there's a deficit of 464 per life per month there compared to the actual deficit of 85. And maybe one way to think about what this shows is what I would call a justifiable or a permissible or an appropriate deficit if you want to pool your PMBs across options. Does it make sense? Almost saying to the regulator, you should be comfortable with allowing a deficit of up to 464 rands per life per month in this option because you want to cross-subsidize low risk to high risk. There's some more complexity that I'll get to later. And by means of subtraction, we can then look at the supplementary benefits here where you can test whether people are paying for other people's benefits. You know, that's always the fear. If I'm on a comprehensive option and I've got optometry benefits and you're not on a comprehensive option and you don't have optometry benefits, then maybe you should cross-subsidize my PMBs, but you shouldn't be cross-subsidizing my optometry benefits. So that's what we're trying to test here, to say if you look at all of the non-common benefits, at least those people are paying their own way and washing their own faces, right? So this is the kind of thinking that I think, you know, the idea, the dream is to come up with some kind of schedule or analysis or model that the regulator or the auditors or any stakeholder out there could apply in their testing of this provision of the Act. Here's another example of a 10-option scheme. I've obfuscated the numbers a little bit, but it's all based on real life. And again, without going into the detail, you'll see here I'm taking non-health into account. There are some loss-making options in this medical scheme. Half of the options are making losses. If we then separate out the PMBs using a community-rated PMB contribution and subtracting PMB claims, then we get to some of those options are suggesting that it might be justifiable for this one to make a loss based on its profile. That's what I'm trying to suggest here. We can talk about justifiable losses or permissible losses or appropriate losses. I don't know what the right words would be. And if we take the balance, and here I'm adding NHG as well, we get to this question as to whether some people are paying for other people's benefits. And here we do end up with, out of the five that are loss-making, two still appear not to be washing their faces in terms of the supplementary benefits. And that could mean that there's something inappropriate and inappropriate cross-subsidy, but it could also mean that there's a maybe an income cross-subsidy justification. And, you know, we've been thinking about whether it's possible to do this. I don't think on publicly available data you can support this. But I think in an ideal world, a regulator could do this kind of test. And for the options that fail, it could say to a medical scheme, please provide us with the socioeconomic justification. So, you know, it would be up to the medical scheme to see if it can get some income data from Stats SA or from employers and suggest that an income-based cross-subsidy of X rands is appropriate before you dismiss this as a non-compliant option. So I guess that's more or less the thinking that I have, but there's a last layer of complexity to think about, of course, and that's investment income and reserve building. So a high reserve scheme, as I said earlier, should use some investment income to pay its expenses. Another way of saying that is a high reserve scheme should be budgeting for deficits. Otherwise, those high reserves will keep on becoming higher forever. So when Daniel and I thought through this, we can bring other income and investment income into the equation in this model. But once you do that, I also want to make sure that you maintain some kind of a reserve strain. I don't have a better word, but maybe we can come up with the terminology. What I suggest with the reserve strain is if you increase your contributions by 100 million rands and you're targeting 25 million solvency, then that means you've increased your reserve strain with 25 million rands. So before I take credit for investment income, I must subtract this reserve strain from it if I want to maintain reserves going forward. And we're looking at two reserve strains. The one is to say if you maintain your current reserves, so if you're at 60%, you want to stay at 60%, and the other one is if you're aiming to eventually whittle down to 25%. So for higher option schemes, you might be able to take more credit for your reserve that can be released. So it's simply taking your aggregate contribution increase, like expressed in aggregate rand amount, minus other sources of income, and then multiply that with a targeted solvency. Okay, so I'll show you a little bit more about what those results do. And again, we must bear in mind that an income cross-subsidy might require separate justification, because most of what this framework does is look at risk. And then finally, for PMB identification, I think I must recognize that it's problematic. Something that the regulator would be able to enforce with relative ease would be just to take a curve like this, which they do publish now, as to what the PMB curve looks like. And of course, it will not be entirely accurate, but we must keep pragmatism in mind. So maybe there's four layers of testing is where my thinking is right now, and I'd love to hear thoughts from you before we ventilate this wider. But test number one, is it surplus-making or is it loss-making? That's what the regulator is doing today. If it's loss-making, we proceed to test number two, which is say, well, after looking at a community-rated profile-based risk adjustment, is it okay then, based on PMBs like I showed? If that test fails, we can proceed even further to say, well, if you take investment income into account, but also the reserve strain to maintain your current reserves, does that allow the loss to be justified? And finally, if you take the investment income or other income into account and look at the reserve strain that would be required to maintain 25% reserves, does that still allow the losses? And if all of that fails, then you still ask, is there an income-based justification? You know, so when you deal with a low-income plan, you might want it to make losses, even if all of the others don't, because we still want to promote income-based cross-subsidies. So this is possible to do based on publicly available data. So, of course, Daniel did it. I didn't ask him to, but he just did it anyway. And this is for every option in the country. There are 227 options in our country that belong to multi-option schemes where one or more of the options are loss-making. We're not looking at single-option schemes here. If you look at the first column, of the 227. The ones that are blue are surplus making. We're not interested in those right now. But the ones in red, just to give you a sense of the count, obviously not identifying them, although this is all based on publicly available stuff. The red ones would be the loss-making ones. And those are the ones that are currently, you know, showing non-compliance notes in the audited financials and receiving letters. And those are 113. So almost half of the options out there are loss-making today. So almost half of the industry is non-compliant. And, of course, I think it's inappropriate to think like that. If we adjust for PMBs, like a profile adjustment based on the PMB cost curve, as I showed with the community rate, then that number reduces in 2022 to 71 options. If we then further bring investment income into account, so that's to say those schemes that have enough investment income that they could or should, you know, without compromising their reserves, use some investment income to fund deficits in options, then that number reduces to 55. And then the last one brings it down to 51. The last one is important because we do have some schemes. The classic example in our country is Anglo Medical Scheme, which, as you probably know, has reserved billions of rands on its balance sheet to fund future claims expenses of its members. There's like historical reasons for that, not to go into that, but that's a decision the scheme made 30 years ago. It's got like 2,000% of reserves, or so, I don't know what the number is, and the explicit intention is to use these reserves over the remaining lifetime of the members. So in those instances, we must make provision for the last loss-making options to look at what it would mean at 25 and not at 25. And then you can see we're still left with 51 options that might or might not be appropriate. And I think those are the ones that the regulator could focus on. There might very well be options out there that are unfairly subsidized or unfairly subsidizing. And that should be what the interpretation of self-supporting in 33.2b, I think, should be focusing on. And of those, of course, there's still the question as to whether you can motivate a socioeconomic case for an income cross-subsidy, which I think could be possible based on some stats essay, based on the scheme's specific circumstances. Many schemes have good income data, especially for the low-cost products, and because many of them have income bands, so you have a sense of what those members are earning, and you could be able to construe some kind of case as to what income cross-subsidy is appropriate. Just as another test, we ran this for Health Squared Medical Scheme, of course. It was one of the ones we looked at. And interestingly, if you look at 2022, the loss-making options, all of them showed inappropriate losses, and it also unsurprisingly showed that no amount of investment income or the little bit of reserves left at the time would have been justifiable, maybe just as another check to see whether there's a sensible result coming out of this. So that's what I want to propose. I don't think any of what I'm saying is rocket science. I don't think any of this is unfamiliar to this audience, but I don't think we talk about it enough, and I don't think we articulate it clearly enough. I don't think this is a conversation that's even happening. So I think there should be a paper out there, and I think there should be some proposal out there. And maybe some of you got better ideas than I have, but I think to try, you know, trying to keep it kind of simple, trying to use PMBs as a proxy for common benefits, there are all kinds of caveats and shortcomings to this kind of approach, like PMB identification is tricky. You know, the common benefits may well, in most schemes, have common benefits that are not PMBs. You could argue that those should form part of the cross-subsidy calculation. You might even argue that some non-common benefits could still be risk cross-subsidized, like my optometry benefit of earlier. Maybe there's some justification for that, but I think that would be complex. Of course, very importantly, not all PMBs are equal. Some options have tight networks and some don't have tight networks. And of course, it's possible to adjust for that in these kinds of calculations, but I think you will just lose the complexity, will just make it, you know, impossible to apply if you need to make those kinds of adjustments as well, if you want to do it in a widespread basis. And as I said, income cross subsidies must be separately justified. And, you know, I want to aim for something that's pragmatic and implementable and understandable and accessible by all stakeholders, not just actuaries. If you ever dream, it is a dream that you can have this kind of conversation with a regulator. It must be pragmatic and easily understandable. And so I've put some concluding remarks on the slide that I'm not going to read through, But this is my thinking, and the purpose of presenting it here today is really just to solicit some comments. Maybe you think it's a good idea or a bad idea, or maybe you think there's a different way one can go about it. I just want to suggest, I think it's extremely important we do something about this, because I think there's some very real harm being done in our industry because of the way that sick people are required to pay more and more and more over time. The final point I want to make is that I think schemes should have some freedom to think very carefully about where they position their pricing. So you might deliberately want to segregate some risks to keep low income or to keep more affordable products in your product range. So we all know that if you do a full cross-subsidy, your cheaper options are just going to become much more expensive and you might price yourself out of the market. But by the same token, the way the regulator is enforcing, especially on the high end, the loss-making products right now, is discriminating against people based on their state of health. I think that could be a wonderful optimization exercise for an actuary to ponder. You might want a little bit of the segregation and still, pricing a lower option on the level where it is, but also allowing some degree of cross-subsidization to the top. And what I'm trying to do with a PMB kind of community-rated model is just provide the regulator with a yardstick to say when is it too much, which cross-subsidies are permissible and which ones are not permissible. And there might be some discretion that you can apply just commercially, thinking about where your competitors are and where you want to be and price your products in between in there. So this is my thinking. It's something that I've wanted to put out there for quite some time now. Clayton and Nick Hudson prevented me to last year, but maybe this year they'll give me a chance. I'd love to hear some comments. If not now, then you can mail me at any stage or have a chat that we can work to some kind of a framework that we can maybe propose. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's me again. thank you very much, Christoph. A very thought-provoking presentation, as always. I just had one question around the common PMB contribution that doesn't flex for age distribution differences across different options. And maybe I missed something, but would it not make sense to have a PMB level contribution for each one of the options that differentiates based on the underlying demographics? But just before you answer that, just to add to a comment, in the statutory returns, I totally understand your pain about identifying PMBs, because that's my job when I submit the data that you're analyzing in the returns. The issue is that the statutory returns actually provide a data validation or a data reasonability check, which is based on Section A7, the scheme risk measurement, saying your PMB reported levels are either too high or too low, based on a very similar calculation that you just presented. So in theory, they understand it when they're doing their own validation of the data, and yet they're not applying it in the kind of regulations, which is very interesting. I think you could use that in your argument.
Okay, thanks. That's a great comment. On the risk adjustment, so I'm suggesting the community-rated PMB contribution is what I calculate as a scheme-wide age contribution applied to that risk curve. You subtract from that the option profile applied to the same curve. Both of those are there, and that gives you this kind of hypothetical. And again, I'm aiming for pragmatism here. I think you could do it on actual claims, but I think if you want to hand a tool to the regulator, say, this is what you can use to test appropriateness, then something like this goes a long way. I'm not suggesting it's perfect at all. And I think one want to test it. We've tested it across many schemes, across all the schemes practically, but I think you want to test it just to make sure that it doesn't throw out some inadvertent artifacts. Then as for the PMB curves, and inside we have the unenviable privilege of seeing many, many sources of data from many systems. Some are extremely sophisticated and some are extremely unsophisticated. I guess I just want to say I'm not blind to that. Some people are relatively unsophisticated in the identification of PMBs, and it's because of the complexity of PMBs. I think there are good reasons for that. And I think council is actually doing a relatively good job, as you say, of trying to introduce some checks and balances, whether the checks and balances are perpetuating a garbage in, garbage out situation on its own remains to be seen. But I'd rather than trying to come up with a perfect definition of PMBs, I'd rather want to proceed and put something pragmatic on the table. And I guess if you ultimately get to the point of proposing this to the regulator themselves, using their own curves might be less controversial. It's time for IFRS 17.
But before that, Christoph, one more question. So as a tool, it seems good. My one thought is that the message is not complete. And if you look at one of the requirements was that the option shouldn't affect other options, whatever the wording is. So certainly, for instance, if you said, okay, I need to correct this option, push up premiums, then I get buy down, the option below it falls flat, the scheme goes into a spiral and dies. You know, so that's an extreme play out. So even the health squared example, I suspect if you tried to close those four options and put those people elsewhere, the scheme would have been even worse off quickly. So I think there is another layer of the argument, maybe not for the tool, but that just says, okay, if I try to correct this option, I'm going to have buy down, the option below it, wherever, is going to be worse off. At a scheme level, we're worse off. So I think there's a layer of a message that could be added there as well.
Yeah. Right, it's an important point. So I think the first point to make about a half squared, it's maybe from one perspective, it's a bit silly for me to put it up there. The primary diagnosis of health squared, I said at the beginning, we have two kinds of risk equalization, inter-scheme and intra-scheme. And I was not talking about intra, which is between options. You know, many things went wrong with health squared, and I don't want to discount whether the trustees or other parties did something wrong. But if you go back to first principles, the absence of a risk equalization fund between schemes was a big part of the problem. So just to bear in mind, I'm talking today about risk equalization inside of a scheme, for lack of a better word, but equally important and for the exact same reasons and the same reasoning and same everything, you need risk equalization between schemes, and that would have saved half squared, because within half squared, there was nothing that could be done. I think I said at BHF 2 weeks ago, whether Alex or me, or Matthew, or any one of you, or the registrar, or the curator was in charge, if you put any one of us in charge of Half Squared 3 years before its demise, there was nothing you could do. You couldn't increase its premiums, because the little bit of good risk left would have been chased away. You couldn't attract young and healthy lives. We did. We helped the curator with some signal model estimates, and we saw that the products of Half Squared at the time were already costing 60 to 80% more than their competitors just before. There's no way you could have attracted health. You couldn't amalgamate, and we know that because they literally asked every scheme in the country, and everyone said no. What you could have done, if I put any one of you in charge of Health Squared 3 years before the liquidation date, the only reasonable thing you could have done was to liquidate sooner. Give the members more notice to get their affairs in order and hopefully maybe have more reserves to distribute to the members when you do liquidate. So the half squared example is a little bit of saying that should have come from the outside. You couldn't have saved the scheme from the inside. As to your point about D and compromising, I think that's exactly the point I want to evoke, is that most of those top-end comprehensive loss-making schemes that are struggling today and receiving letters saying you're non-compliant with the Act. And then when you look at those schemes, those options require 20 or 30% contribution increases to become self-sustaining. And there, I'm saying if you can invoke, I didn't articulate it like that today, but you can invoke 33.2D. So you can't do that because you would compromise the well-being of the other options. And that's why I'm hoping my framework will give you a framework to say, based on this, this is still a reasonable cross-subsidy into that option so that it does not compromise the existence of the other options. So I think it's all a little bit in there if you look at the spirit of the Act in a broader sense.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Thanks, Christoph.